This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And on the line with us is Anand Giridharadas. I'm sorry if I'm mangling it, Anand. Could you welcome? First of all, welcome to the program, and please tell me how to pronounce your last name.
Yeah, it's Anand Giridharadas.
Okay, thank you very much. And I am so looking forward
to
your
good progressive America we're building is like we learned to say Dostoevsky and Tchaikovsky, so we gotta start expanding the palette.
I agree. And after I've said it a few times, I will have it.
It'll roll off the tongue after a little bit. But I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anand, and I'm looking forward to your book. It was supposed to arrive here before now. I guess it's going to be delivered today, but I saw a couple of interviews that you did a week or so ago, I'm very much looking forward to that. Winners Take All, the Elite Charade of Changing the World. And I want to talk to you about that, but first, Silicon Valley, Saudi Arabia problem. You published this piece over the last week, I believe it was, and you talk about Uber and the dog walking app Wag and DoorDash and Slack and the thing that all of these things have in common is Saudi Arabia. Tell us about this.
You know, many of your listeners listening in on this program will have taken an Uber. Many will have ordered lunch every now and then from the app DoorDash. Many will have used, as you say, have had their dog walked by Wag. Many will have, gone to a co-working space called WeWork or had boring office conversations about things of zero consequence on the website Slack. And what a lot of your listeners may not know is that all of those apps and technologies are brought to you by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has long cultivated Washington and long cultivated U.S. industry in terms of arms purchases. Prince Alawid a long time ago had a big stake in Citigroup, but in
Fox News.
You're right. But a relatively new front has been opened in which the Saudis, under this new Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, have made a strong push into Silicon Valley, acting through a kind of open secret of a front, which is a big Japanese fund called SoftBank, which had a thing called a Vision Fund, $100 billion fund that has been throwing cash around Silicon Valley and the tech industry globally. And $45 billion of that Vision Fund was actually Saudi money, as we said in this piece in the Times that actually runs today on the op-ed page. And now there's a second Vision Fund coming out, another $100 billion, $45 billion of that, again, from Saudi Arabia. And so you have this fascinating situation where a regime that has been aptly described as an ISIS that made it. In other words, a kind of ISIS worldview that turned itself into a nation state and whose legitimacy comes not from any kind of moral leadership, but from the fact that it managed to commandeer a country. Basically now infiltrating the apps that many millions of Americans use as part of their daily conveniences. And I think we all need to think about, the Jamal Khashoggi case. Certainly it's not the first time we should have thought about the abuses of Saudi Arabia, but sometimes stories grip the world, like that Syrian boy on a beach in Europe some years ago. And this story is an opportunity for us to think afresh about what has frankly long been a toxic and abusive relationship with Saudi Arabia that we need to get the hell out of.
Yeah, I'm guessing you saw this op-ed in the Washington Post over the weekend, "Will You Work for a Murderer?" Specifically about this issue, and it's really quite remarkable how a single person's story can turn the world. Whereas you hear 10,000 civilians bombed in Yemen, and it's like, oh well, it's 10,000 people, but you see one person's picture, and all of a sudden it gets real. Tell us about Winners Take All.
Yeah, Winners Take All.
Your book.
The piece that I was describing grows out of it because Winners Take All is a book that I have been working on for the last 3 years, just out. And it is about how the very rich and powerful in the United States have been playing an extraordinary double game. a double game sort of captured in the Saudi Arabia cash story, but on a much grander scale. And the double game is the following, Tom. On one hand, and many of your listeners will recognize this, we live in an age in which rich people seem to be bending over backwards to do good, to give back, to make the world a better place. Which Silicon Valley baron is not in the middle of three or four major efforts to make the world a better place? Their company is building community. They're colonizing Mars to create a refuge in case we ruin the Earth. They're ending all the diseases through philanthropy. They're helping homelessness. They're in charge of fixing the schools of Newark, onward and onward. You have all these young people on elite campuses. You step onto any elite campus today and you ask young people, what do you want to do with your life? Virtually every college senior has some plan to, you know, start a social enterprise that will turn recycled poop into coffee and somehow then, you know, barter it for tote bags in Rwanda or something like that. You know, you have this extraordinary compassion of America's elite today. And at the same time, the numbers are staggering because this is the most unequal time in America in about 100 years. This is the kind of inequality that led to the Great Depression. This is also the kind of this is a period in which the winners have cornered almost all of the benefits of progress over the last 30, 40 years. This is a period in which 82% of new wealth created last year went to the global top 1%. And so you have this way in which the winners of our age claim to be saving us and helping us and changing the world, but they are engaged in building and maintaining and upholding a winners-take-all economy that siphons almost all the gains from progress to the top and shuts most Americans out of the American dream. And I decided to go on a journey to report on this, but I did one thing a little differently, Tom, which is when most people write about inequality, when most reporters get into that subject, they report from the bottom. They report from the people to whom inequality is happening. And I decided to try something different with this book, which is to actually write about inequality from the vantage point of the top. Because to write about inequality from the bottom is to write about a house by profiling the people living in it and ignoring the architect. It is not the poor who design our unequal economy. It is the rich who design it and fight for it and keep it. And so I decided to spend time reporting on it, and I went into those worlds. I reported from what I talk about as kind of the inner sanctums of our new Gilded Age and tried to understand how the people on top engage in this kind of cognitive dissonance of trying to make the world better while preserving a system that causes the very problems they seek to solve.
Anand Giridharadas, I still don't have it, sir.
Anand Giridharadas, but we'll get there.
I will. Anand Giridharadas. The book is Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Would it be accurate to kind of summarize this, to boil this down to simple English, and not that yours isn't, but you know, you went through a whole series of things to say, basically back in the 80s when the Reagan administration and the Republicans rewrote the rules of American capitalism in some really significant ways, stopping in the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act, busting up unions, you know, doing away with workers' rights, starting the rightward shift of the Supreme Court, all these things, that basically they and the billionaires who funded them initiated a multi-trillion-dollar, I think it's $14-15 trillion transfer of wealth from the middle class and working people in the United States to the top 1%, and in the process used that as a rationalization. This is, you know, the old two Santa Claus theory, you know, from the 70s of, you know, run up massive debt when Republicans are in office and then scream about it when Democrats come into office so they'll cut Social Security and things. And then they used this transfer of wealth and this change in tax code to justify the gutting of the social safety net. And now the billionaires who benefited from all this are stepping in and saying, we'll be the new social safety net. If that's exactly what you're describing, that sounds like it sounds like virtually the definition of the kind of libertarianism and objectivism that Ayn Rand talked about and that in 1980 David Koch ran for vice president on the platform of. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that was, Tom, you've stolen my book tour stump speech. That is exactly right. And the reality is, you know, many of your listeners will know this expression, it's like a fox guarding a hen house. the way I often describe the story you just told very well is we are the hens in this analogy, the American people. And the hens used to have a guard, and the guard was the government. It wasn't perfect, but it was, you know, it worked, it protected us, it can always be better. And in the 1970s and then 1980s, as you say, a fox came around and decided that the guard was a threat. And that fox was business interests that decided through the Powell memo starting the 70s and onward that they needed to take the reins of government, that they needed to fight for their interests and have kind of the Chamber of Commerce libertarian view of the world more dominant in political life. And they succeeded. They got Reaganism, they got Thatcherism, they got Bill Clinton in 1996 to declare that the era of big government was over. And as their revolution succeeded, the fox bit the guard in the leg. Government had less money, less capability, fewer people to do things, became less capable of solving those social problems. Meanwhile, business flourished because it was not being, you know, policed. And then the hens are unguarded because the fox has bit the hen and the fox has bit the guard in the leg. And the fox comes around in the hens and says, "What a shame, you're unguarded. What a shame. This is so tragic. Allow me to step in and, you know, be your guard." And it's an extraordinary game that has been played. The very people, I get this all the time from business guys, and it's always guys who say, you know, "Well, I agree with you in theory, but don't you think the government is underfunded and weak?" And I say, "Yeah, because of business people, because of people who pushed for a government that regulates less and taxes less." I'll tell you one story on that I find so powerful.
We just have 15 seconds, sir.
David Rubenstein from the Carlyle Group, famously a patriotic philanthropist, as he calls himself, gave money when the Washington Monument broke to repair half the money because the government couldn't afford it. So the government can't afford things, I got to step in. David Rubenstein had fought tooth and nail for the carried interest loophole that made the government have less money. These people are fighting on both sides of a war.
Right. Yeah. And this, and we've been hearing this pitch forever that, charity should be, the province of the rich and the churches, right? That, you know, it's just nuts. Anand, thanks so much for being with us today. And I'm so looking forward to your book, Winners Take All. Thank you for being
with
us.
Thank you for having me.
Great talking with you. And I look forward to talking with you again. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of your calls and the news of the day right after this. Stick around. And welcome back. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for being there. Well, you recall most recently Chuck Grassley, Lindsey Graham, and Senator Marble Mouth Mitch McConnell are all doing this Frank Luntz-like mental gymnastics to reframe a couple of women at the Jeff Flake elevator the other day as representing some kind of angry mob out of control that threatens their very lives, including those activists at the back of the hearing room who are just practicing democracy.
Right.
So I'm bringing this up is because I have one of the many strategies I think we could be employing for dealing with the expected Republican Party voter suppression tactics at the polling places. So in advance of voting day and early voting even, what we could be doing and should be doing online as well as when we actually go to the polling place is to have side-by-side comparison videos. Now, I know they didn't have video phones back in 2000 during the Florida recount, but I did see on Free Speech TV a number of years ago a documentary that included a reenactment of those paid, what I call, Republican Party crisis actors who were screaming and yelling and banging on the glass door, demanding to be let in. And they were let in by the law enforcement on duty there because law enforcement tends to be conservative, as we all know. So what we should do is be playing that reenactment side by side with these women at the elevator crying to Jeff Flake, expressing their trauma and what kind of consequences he can have as a senator, and then use that as a way of shooting down Grassley, Graham, and McConnell's stupid idea about how the mob is represented in the Democratic Party. What do you think about that?
I think it's an idea. I think it's a good idea, Johnny. I think that there is you know, just think for a minute, if the Republican Party were the victims of voter suppression, the way that the Democratic Party is, how would they be fighting back right now? If the Republican Party was the victim of, you know, the stacking the courts in ways that would work against the Republican Party, how would they be fighting back? And I can tell you, it would be brutal, it would be fast, it would be efficient, it would be across all the media. I mean, they basically control all radio media in the all political radio media in the United States already, and a good chunk of the television media. They've got their own networks from Glenn Beck's Blaze to Fox so-called News, and they would just be raising holy hell. And you know, we talked to Tom Perez. The Democrats are raising hell. They are doing lawsuits. They have set up a hotline and all this, but it's getting absolutely no coverage. And it's not because the Democrats aren't talking about it. And that's the only kind of fly in the ointment with your idea, Johnny, is that, you know, unless you had, a friendly local billionaire who's going to put up Koch brothers level money to take that ad that you're talking about national, it just won't get covered by the press because the press does not cover the Republican crimes. If a Democrat gets caught, oh, my God, let's talk about this, you know, forever. But, you know, Bill Clinton got a BJ. Oh, my God. But if a Republican is in trouble, four of the five floor leaders who are...
That is, we produce these videos, these side-by-side video, and put it on the internet, on the virtual reality for young folks, and show up at various key broadcast stations, terrestrial.
Well, put together the video, Johnny, and post it to me on Twitter. And I'll do my best to redistribute it, if anybody else has the skill to do that. Johnny, thank you for the call. Fascinating idea. We'll be back. Welcome back. We've got to edit that one, Sean. Welcome back. Let's see here. Noel in Corpus Christi, Texas. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, you are. Thank you.
Hey, Noel. What's up?
Hi, Dr. Tom. I'm calling because I've had a question for a while about the two Santa Claus theory, and you mentioned it a minute ago. It prompted me to call.
Mm-hmm.
When the Democrats take over and they have the debt run up by the Republicans, instead of cutting Medicare and Social Security entitlements, quote-unquote, as Republicans say, why don't Democrats just raise taxes on the wealthy to pay the debt down instead?
Well, that's exactly what Barack Obama did. He passed the largest middle-class tax cut in the history of the United States, and he raised the top income tax rate on rich people by, as I recall, 3%. And, Bill Clinton did that, too. He raised taxes slightly. Again, neither of these were bold moves, you know, like Franklin Roosevelt did, where he took it from 25% to 91%. But it's a start. And then, of course, Republicans come in and say, and by the way, as a result of raising those taxes, Bill Clinton's last two budgets were balanced, and four of Barack Obama's eight budgets were balanced. But then the Republicans come in and say, we really don't want balanced budgets. We just want to scream about them when Democrats are in office. We want to blow up the budget so that we can, you know, scream loudly and get the Democrats to do things that'll hurt themselves, like raising taxes or cutting spending. It's a real cynical game, Noel. It's a real cynical game.
Yes.
But to your point, Democrats have done that to a certain extent. And the Democrats who are running for election now, the progressives, the Bernie-crats have largely seized the momentum of the Democratic Party. And I think the number one candidate out there right now is Elizabeth Warren. And who I'm going to talk about more in the third hour of the program, but keep an eye on Elizabeth Warren because there's some good stuff coming here, and she's talking about raising taxes on rich people, and she's talking about it without fear, which is pretty powerful stuff for Democrats. So I think we can do it.
I hope so.
Yeah, me too. And not only can we do it, but by doing so, we make our tax code fairer because rich people do use a disproportionate part of our commons, which is what taxes pay for, and we make our tax and we make our economy fairer because when you raise taxes on very, very rich people, in order to avoid the taxes, they take less income, and that's why when Reagan came into office, the richest CEOs in America only made 30 times what their employees made, and now they're making 500 times what their employees made. It's very, very simple. It has to do with the top tax rate. So we've got to do something about that. Noel, thanks for the call. It's a great one. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Tom Hartman here with you, defending democracy in America against the agents of disinformation. It's 34 minutes past the hour. 34 minutes, 37 seconds. Spencer in Albion, Indiana. Hey, Spencer, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Hey. I want to tell you thank you for taking my call. I'm an independent, and I agree on, you know, some things on both sides. And I have a question for you. I am seeing more on my paycheck, and I want to know why the tax cuts are a bad thing, because actually it is benefiting, you know, me and my family. So I just...
How much do you make, Spencer? A year?
Around 120 grand a year.
Yeah, okay. So you're probably getting a tax cut of what, around $1,000 a year?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Okay. So you think that, well, okay, here's a couple of reasons why this is not a good thing. Number one, you are starving our government, yours and mine, of the money necessary to do everything from fill potholes and run police and fire departments to have good schools, education, all, you know, basically all the stuff that keeps America America is being cut back, and being cut back radically, with the singular exception of our military. Number two, in order to fund this tax cut, literally every penny of it was borrowed. It's a $6 trillion tax cut over a decade. The first $1.5 trillion in the first 2 years, which we're seeing right now, all of that is being funded by buying treasuries. It's going to have to be paid back with interest. The interest is going to be another $1 trillion. And that hurts our country. In fact, that may provoke a crisis for our country. We're at the point now with over $20 trillion in debt, where if interest rates go up 2 points, and they certainly have in the past, in the 70s, you know, the prime was all the way up to around 8 or 9%. You know, right now it's in the neighborhood of 2%. If interest rates go up another 2 points, the interest on the national debt, the annual payments of interest, will be greater than everything that we pay to fund the Pentagon, all of our wars and everything. And that's mind-boggling, and it's not good, and it's not healthy. And then number three, because of that massive debt and what I just described, you know, when Democrats come into office, the Republicans are going to be screaming, okay, it's time to end Social Security, it's time to end long-term unemployment benefits, it's time to end food stamps, it's time to end any support for college. When I went to college, you know, when I went to MSU briefly back in the 1960s, and Lansing Community College as well, 80% of the cost of college, it cost me, my recollection is $150 a term to go to MSU. 80% of the cost of college in the 1960s was paid for by state and local governments and the university. 20% was paid for by tuition. As a consequence of Reagan's policy changes, particularly those who were championed by Bill Bennett, his racist Secretary of Education, now 80% of the cost of education is paid for with tuition, and only 20% is paid for by government. So what we've had is this massive shift away from a society for all of us, where anybody could, you know, I mean, you know, my parents were not wealthy. My dad worked in a tool and die shop. He could not afford to put me through college. But I was able to work my way through college to the extent that I did. I ultimately got kicked out, but, you know, or dropped out, I suppose, is more technically correct. But the bottom line is, I was able to do that because in minimum wage jobs, I worked as a waiter. I was a waiter for one day when the waitresses went on strike. But as a dishwasher in Bob's Big Boy on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing, and across the street at the ExxonMobil station, I changed tires and pumped gas, and, you know, for, as I recall, $2.30 an hour or something like that. With that minimum wage part-time job that was a little more full-time in the summer, I could pay for college, and it's because that's how things were. The complete change in all of these things, right? You know, making it impossible to go to college, making healthcare massively more expensive, shifting everything out of not-for-profit into for-profit. All of that was predicated, that whole horrible, you know, chain of horribles. The Republican Party in the last year of the Bush administration, you know, cutting long-term unemployment benefits from 3 years down to 1 year, and then cutting it again down to 6 months. All of that was because they're cutting taxes. If you were to go, as I did, live in Germany for a year, where somebody with your level of income, you know, well over $100,000, would be paying as much as 40% of your income in taxes, you would have free health care, you would have free college. In fact, your kids would get a stipend when they go to college. You'd have one of the best public education systems in the world. You would have highway systems and road systems that are so well maintained that you can travel 130 miles an hour on the freeway. You would have, I could go on and on, right? And you would have a much higher minimum wage. The fact of the matter is, the other argument that I would make, Spencer, and I've made this before, but you know it's worth repeating. In fact, I've written op-eds about this. You can easily find them. Is that tax cuts affect? There's two different categories of people in the United States in terms of income. There's people who have control over their income, and there's people who don't have control over their income. And if you're a wage earner, if you're getting a salary, and you're working for somebody else, you don't have control over your income, broadly speaking. I mean, you can petition for a raise or whatever, but you basically don't have control over your income. If you are an entrepreneur, if you own your own business, or if you are a very, very wealthy person or a CEO in a large corporation, you basically control your own income. You can choose how much money you get. So for when you look at the labor market, if you take out of the labor market that top 1 or 2%, maybe as much as 3% of Americans who actually have some control over their income, for that group of people, when taxes are cut, their income actually goes up. But your employer, and let's say that you're working for Acme Company, because I don't want to ask you on the air who is paying you 120 grand a year, but let's say that your employer, Acme, knows that you just got a tax cut that, you know, $1,000 is pretty inconsequential, and it's also temporary, so it's probably not going to cause a huge dislocation. But let's say that you got a tax cut that was worth $20,000 a year. Now, before, with $120,000 of income, you're probably paying around 30% taxes, so you're probably taking home, at the end of the day, around 85 grand. Am I right, more or less? 70 yeah. to 80 grand? Okay. So that's now, perfect. Your employer knows that you're willing to work for a take-home pay of $75,000 to $80,000 a year. They know that because you're doing it, right? And now, as a result of a tax cut, you're taking home $95,000 or $100,000 a year. Now, your employer knows you'll work for $75,000. So over time, what's your employer going to do, Spencer? They're going to do one of two things. They're either going to cut your wages directly, but that's sometimes very difficult to do, or they're going to make your job unpleasant or uncomfortable or whatever, and when you finally quit that job and you get replaced, you're going to get replaced by somebody who's making $20,000 a year less than you are, because they're then taking the same take-home pay, and you have established that the market for your particular job is worth 85 grand a year take-home pay. So, and you can see this by looking at the tax graphs versus the wage graphs, and I'm talking wages, so we're talking 100%, people who don't have control over their income, going all the way back to 1920. Every time, because in 1920, Harding dropped the top tax rate from 91% to 25%. In 1934, FDR raised it back up to 91%. In 1967, LBJ dropped it down to 74%. And then in 1983, Reagan dropped it down to 25%. Then it slowly floated back up. Every single time, if you look at a three-year window, every single time working people's wages are cut, over the next 3 to 5 years, working people's wages decline for the reason I just described to you. Similarly, every time working people's wages go up, you know, again, let's go back to your employer. He's paying you 120 grand. He knows you're taking home 85 grand. And let's say that the Democrats come in and they raise your taxes by $20,000 a year. So you're now only taking home 65 grand. And you're going to go to your employer and say, you know, I'm not willing to do this job for 65 grand. You know, and nobody else in the labor market is, because this is an 85 grand take-home pay job. So you need to raise my wages from 120 grand a year to 140 grand a year. And they will do it, because that's what happens when when taxes go up. That's why in Denmark, where the tax that is paid by somebody making $20,000 or $30,000 a year U.S. equivalent is still almost 40%, it's like 36%, the minimum wage in Denmark is $14.35 an hour. Excuse me, $18.35 an hour. You know, the functional minimum wage in many European countries that are high tax countries is around $20 an hour. So The bottom line is it always evens out. The only people, in other words, as taxes go up, your wages are going to go up. As taxes go down, your wages are going to go down. You're always going to have basically the same take-home pay, which is defined as a function of the marketplace. The only people who are actually affected in a consequential way, who actually get richer as a result of tax cuts or get less rich as a result of tax increases, are the people who have control over their pay, the very, very wealthy. Did I make any sense at all, Spencer?
Absolutely, and I appreciate your insight.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to hear it, and I'm glad my examples are working. Spencer, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, this is probably the most unknown economic reality. It's just a simple economic reality. We should be teaching this in seventh grade in high school as part of a civics class or even an economics class. Everybody in America should understand this because it's easy to just look at the tables over a 100-year period, and not just in the United States. You can look at any of the developed countries in the world, all over the world, the OECD countries of the world. The higher the taxes, the higher the wages. The lower the taxes, the lower the wages. And ancillary to that, the lower the taxes, the richer the rich. And the higher the taxes, the less rich the rich, and the richer is the middle class. It's just that simple. We need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts and go back to a 74% top rate. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with Talk Media News in about 4 minutes, find out what Bob Ney has to tell us. Stick around. And welcome back. Dave in Joplin, Missouri. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today? Excuse me. Or Dion, I'm sorry, it's not Dave, it's Dion. My glasses broke last Wednesday, so I've been wearing contact lenses for the last 5 days, and it's a little harder to read the screen. I'm sorry. Dion, what's on your mind?
I listened to a little bit of your Tom Perez interview, and I found it extremely frustrating because there's an example of how to get voters right now for the Democratic Party, and it's in the governor's race in Georgia.
Right.
Stacey Abrams is trying to get the people that didn't vote. And it doesn't seem like Tom Perez of the Democratic Party at large has got that lesson that, I'm going to vote Democratic. I'm solid Democratic voter. I get calls all the time from my local party, and I've talked to people in my local Democratic Party about what they're doing for voter outreach for people who haven't voted, and there just isn't any. And I know that Claire McCaskill keeps, her strategy seems to be, I'm sort of conservative, guys, so you can vote for me in this red state. But just like every red state in America, we have two giant blue centers, and they just don't reach out.
The problem Claire McCaskill has and Heidi Heitkamp has is the problem that Harry Truman identified in 1947 when he said that, when the American people are given the choice between voting for a Democrat who behaves like a Republican or an actual Republican, they'll choose the Republican every time. I mean, obviously the converse is true, too. When the American people are given a choice between a Republican who behaves like a Democrat, and there aren't any of those left anymore, so it's kind of a moot point, but there were just 30, 40 years ago, a Republican who behaves like a Democrat or a true Democrat, they'll always choose the true Democrat. And by trying to be a little bit of this and a little bit of that, Claire McCaskill, Heidi Heitkamp, we saw the same thing with Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, which is why she's no longer the senator from Louisiana. And we see this with, probably half a dozen other senatorial candidates, Republican senatorial or Democratic senatorial candidates, and probably 20% of the Democrats in the House of Representatives. They're trying to, suck up to a Republican constituency. And no matter how much they suck up, it's never going to work, Dion.
So why is that lesson over and over? Like Harry Truman, from this state. That's an old lesson. And Claire McCaskill from this state, the template's there. It's pretty obvious. So why is the lesson not being learned? I just don't understand.
I think what happened, and I say this with some sadness, but I think that what happened was back in 1992 when Bill Clinton flipped the Democratic Party from being the party of FDR to being the party of basically Eisenhower, of Republican light, and with the Democratic Leadership Council, him and Al Fromm, and they did all this stuff. There were a bunch of people who came into office over the next 6, 8, 10 years when the Democratic Party was firmly in that place, and it really was right up until the Obama presidency, and it still held many of those values through the Obama presidency. It was really Bernie who flipped it upside down. Those people came into power thinking, okay, what I've got to do is what Bill Clinton did, which is be real, you know, take a lot of money from the so-called clean industries, banking, insurance, things like that, and advocates a few conservative policies, you know, charter schools and stuff, and then, you know, on the other hand, be a Democrat. And it sort of worked for a while, but it doesn't work anymore. But they've been taking this money from these people for so long that they can't walk away from those policies. So Claire McCaskill and Heidi Heitkamp and others are kind of stuck in this position. And, you know, I hope they win the re-election because we need Democratic control of the Senate. But I really think that by not going all progressive and even repudiating their own past, they have doomed themselves. Dion, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. On the line, this report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Loving What You Do, Ellen Ratner's new book. And on the line with us is the author of Sideswiped, Bob Ney. Hey, Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So what's at the top of your hit parade for the news today?
Well, 60 Minutes was at the top this morning anyway. Everybody might be tired of talking about it, you know, by
I
now.
Have not yet discussed it on this show, and I did not see it. Oh. I was flying home from Denver last night and haven't seen the news in a day and a half.
Prime time, I watched the reruns, but watched it. And Leslie Stahl was Leslie Stahl. I've actually been interviewed by her on 60 Minutes before, so I thought she was, you know, rolled out questions, irritated him here and there. But I must say he was a controlled, what I'll call a controlled Trump, compared to what I thought originally, you know, might be happening here.
Well, I bet they rehearsed the hell out of this thing before they put him in front of that camera and her.
Well, you're right, because I've got to tell you, Tom, he was much, if you watch it, much more, you know, in tune, sort of, I'm not saying he had the questions in advance, he didn't, but definitely much more relaxed. Now, Trump is Trump, so he did do some things like when he responded to her, and she was, you know, making an argument and a question. He said, well, you know, I'm the president, you aren't. Mm-hmm. You know, so that type of thing came out. Flynn, he said, well, I think Flynn is a Democrat, is what he said. But I think the Flynn deal is coming. Flynn. I've got Flynn on
You're
my mind.
You're talking about Mattis.
He's going to go to jail. I'm talking about Mattis,
right.
You know, Mad Dog
yeah.
Mattis. Yeah. And he said, well, you know, I think he's a Democrat, is what he said. And on that, though, I think that Mattis is at odds, honestly, with John Bolton and Pompeo. That's what I think.
Yep.
He's considered
especially
too
Bolton.
Mild.
I mean, Pompeo has moderated his position somewhat now that he actually has power. When he was just a Republican congressman and could just basically shoot off his mouth whenever he wanted, he was pretty radical. But he's starting to behave like a reasonable person, but. But Bolton, nah, not a chance,
yeah,
in
not
my
at
opinion.
All. And then the two things also, you know, one was the statement about Mattis, and then he bypassed the issue of making fun of Dr. Ford. You know, of course, he said, I didn't do that.
Right.
You know, that's not what I was doing, et cetera. To me, he started to backtrack on Khashoggi, but then again, of course, today he, quote, you know, talked to the king and feels assured, you know, the king had nothing behind
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but the king probably didn't even know. I mean, the king is in his 80s. He's half senile. This is why MBS is running the country. He's surrendered
right.
his power. I mean, if you want to ask who did it, everybody is saying it was Mohammed bin Salman, the guy who's actually running the country. Why did Trump not want to talk to him? Is it because Jared Kushner talked to him 2 days before this happened? And by the way,
correct.
When Jared Kushner talked to MBS 2 days before this happened, did he give him top secret information that allowed him to do this? Did Jared Kushner give MBS top, you know, the last time these two guys hung out together, about 3 days later, MBS arrested a whole bunch of billionaires in Saudi Arabia and, you know, locked them down in a hotel, tortured some of them. Apparently one of them died and took all their money. Or a good chunk of it.
Oh, yes.
I mean, you know, is Jared Kushner feeding him information and intelligence? Is that what's going on? And is he doing that in exchange for a couple $100 million loan from the Saudis to keep his real estate empire afloat? Or am I just way out here, Bob?
No, I mean, look, let's look at Qatar, right? Let's look at that. His father was trying to get a loan there. All of a sudden, our policies shift. Saudi Arabia gets mad. Trump comes out against Doha, you know, the capital there. And that, again, the relationship between the Crown Prince and Jared Kushner. And you are right. When I read this story today, preparing for your show, I just about died when I saw where the president said that, you know, he talked to the king. The king has Alzheimer's.
Right.
The king doesn't know who he's talking to.
Right.
So
that's my point.
That statement in itself is ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. So, and the Khashoggi thing still continues to heat up now. Mm. Turkey wants a joint look inside the embassy. Of course, there's not going to be anything in the embassy. And the cameras that day didn't function, of all days.
Right.
After, you know,
surprise!
Functioning,
they have, surprise!
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Right. No, you're right. And so they're going to try to do a joint investigation. And then have you talked about Senator Warren taking the DNA test?
I have not. I was going to talk about that in the next hour, but go for it.
Yeah. Well, just, you know, she took a DNA test, and she has Native American, blood in her DNA.
And not just a little bit. They were able to identify. She said, you know, her mother told her it was her great-great-great-grandmother, and, you know, six generations back. And it turns out that six generations back, there was 100% full-blooded Native American in her lineage. So take that, Mr. Trump.
And of course, he promised a million, I believe.
Yes, he promised to give $1 million to the charity of her choice, but now he's lying about that.
Yeah, right, and he's not going to pay it. I think he said, you know, whatever on the issue. Also, there's a...
No, he said, I didn't say that this morning in that press
scrum. Did he say that?
He said, yeah, I didn't say that. He said, go back and read it again.
Whatever. Okay, yeah. I will. And then President, as we noted yesterday, started... he said, well, I don't think climate is a hoax. He started to change his tune, which was interesting, on 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
And there's a big report, bottom line, we're running out of time. There's a great big report of a real dire situation coming out of NASA with global warming.
From NASA?
Yes.
Which is controlled by the administration. Well,
that's from NASA.
That's interesting. I'm looking forward to that.
Right.
Bob Ney, author of Sideswipe. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. We're going to get into a whole bunch of stuff in the next hour, including, you know, the giant voter purges and what's up with Elizabeth Warren.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.